Ms. Anholt.
Good morning. May it please the Court. This is a Section 1983 case involving a due process violation, a Brady claim, as well as supplemental conspiracy and failure to intervene claims relating to that due process claim, as well as a state law malicious prosecution count. It's a consolidated two appeals on a Rule 59 denial of a new trial and a fees issue. On September 21st, 2002, Terrence Thompson was arrested for a crime he didn't commit. He was charged with a UUW for a gun that the officers planted on him. Terrence spent 3 years behind bars before it was revealed publicly that the officers who put him there were from a small team within the Special Operations Section that had been engaging in widespread corruption, a pattern of misconduct going back years. On his civil trial, plaintiff won his due process claim against Officer Sushaki in the city of Chicago, but lost on the other claims against other defendants. He was awarded only $15,000 for the 3 years of wrongful incarceration. To establish his claims, plaintiff needed to prove that each of the defendants knew that the officers who had testified against him in the criminal trial, that Sushaki and McDermott, had been involved in the team's pattern of misconduct. Plaintiff was able to do this against Officer Sushaki by providing witness testimony of incidents within the pattern of misconduct that he was involved in. But unfortunately, all the same kinds of witnesses that could establish the involvement of Brzezinski and McDermott in that pattern were excluded on Rule 403 grounds, not because they weren't probative, they were. Under Rule 403, the court needs to consider the availability of other evidence. And when there's not other evidence available, even if there's some prejudice to the other side, it should be included.
Before trial, didn't the district judge allow more witnesses on these issues than you actually called?
He did allow a few more, not quite the eight that the counsel point to, but there were two witnesses, Davis and Glover, who the judge originally ruled he would allow. We were not able to serve subpoenas on those people in order to get them to come in to testify. I would note that one of them, Mr. Davis, his testimony related to a 2005 incident, which was interesting that the judge was going to allow him because there are other witnesses that the judge excluded because of that timeline.
The judge had a tough problem here, right?
He did, absolutely, and he worked hard with it during the trial. And I think during the trial and during those initial evidentiary rulings, he was considering and was assuming that there was going to be this other evidence available. There wasn't. That turned out to be mistaken. And that's really the role of Rule 59.
Well, I would have thought that it was the role of plaintiff's counsel to get their witnesses in order and under subpoena before asking the district judge to go through all of this balancing and trying to evaluate these issues to keep the trial manageable.
It was unfortunate that those two witnesses did not work out.
There were some other folks you planned to call. And then some credibility problems arose, right? And so
It was found with him. That was the one witness who was actually available to be called at witness who we did at trial who plaintiff determined not to call. That's true. That's Lanier Winder. And he was not, my understanding was that he was not lucid enough or competent enough to really.
And what happened with Wisniewski? I thought that the judge was going to allow him, and then you said you weren't going to call him.
The judge was not going to allow him. What the judge ruled with Wisniewski is if the guns had been planted on Wisniewski, then he would be allowed to be called. But if they weren't, then just like Mr. Fields and some of the other witnesses, if it was a matter of these police officers conducting an illegal search and then fabricating probable cause to support that search, then he wasn't going to allow that. And that was part of the problem with the Rule 403 analysis, is that the judge was wanting the individual incidents to be identical instead of similar, and similar, the similarities needs to be looked at in the context of the pattern that we're talking about. We're talking about police officers who are committing illegal searches and illegal stops and then lying in their police reports and in testimony about the basis for those stops and searches.
The claims that were actually tried are the Brady due process claim, the conspiracy claim, and then a state law claim. Is that right?
Right. We had the due process claim, the conspiracy to commit the due process claim, the failure to intervene in the due process claim, and then the malicious prosecution claim.
So at least with respect to the conspiracy claim, the broader evidence of police misconduct in fabricating charges was highly probative, it seems to me.
It was. And one of the ways that we believe we were prejudiced by the rulings at the trial was that the defense counsel was able to quite powerfully argue these officers didn't have anything to do with it. This, that they were here, they were having to take the Fifth, and that Terrence Thompson's case got dismissed because of something that other people did that was completely separate that they had nothing to do with. And that was very powerful because we weren't able to present the evidence showing their involvement in.
Right. The whole defense was no guilt by association here. This is an isolated incident, or attempted to treat it as an isolated incident, when in fact it was one piece of a larger practice of public corruption.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. And the jury, when we talk about did this affect the outcome for Rule 59 analysis, that argument was even more persuasive and powerful than it might have been in other circumstances, because how is the jury not to buy it? It was the only reasonable explanation for why they hadn't heard the kind of witness testimony about McDermott and Brzezinski's involvement that they heard about Officer Souchacki.
When it became clear during the course of the trial that you couldn't get under subpoena the witnesses that had been allowed in the in limine rulings, what part of that pretrial motion did you renew?
It wasn't completely clear until the last day of plaintiff's evidence. That's when we realized that Mr. Glover was not going to be. He had previously been cooperating with us, and at that point, our investigator wasn't even able to lay a subpoena on him, and so it was towards the end. And so at that point, we renewed the motion to get in at least Officer Villarreal's testimony about Officer Brzezinski planting, being involved in an incident where a gun was planted.
That was the most closely related to the district court's pretrial rationale.
It was.
It was excluded pretrial because of the time frame, as I understand it, but it did meet the court's criteria of being similar enough.
In terms of the similarity, it was close, but the judge found that when talking about this incident, found that the May 2005 was too far away in time.
But the evidence is that this SOS unit was corrupt during that entire time frame, as
absolutely.
I understand it.
Throughout 2006, and also the time frame, Terrence Thompson was convicted in his criminal trial was in 2003, so this is only 2 years later, and it's 2 years while his criminal case is pending. It's 1 year before he gets out of jail, so it's right in the thick of it in terms of Terrence Thompson's case, as well as in terms of the SOS pattern of corruption.
The pretrial rulings regarding the Fifth Amendment assertions by the three defendant officers and the other officers in the SOS unit that were implicated, that was that in the context of negotiations among counsel, or was the court actually asked to permit the officers, permit you to call the officers to insist that they take the Fifth before the jury?
We wanted to call the officer, to put the officers on the stand, and the judge said no, but we could read their they had been deposed, and it was officers and it was their team supervisors.
So you did ask to do that?
We did ask to do that.
That's the normal practice.
Right. And then when we couldn't do that, instead of reading the length, the entire depositions, we came up with stipulations of fact regarding those. And so
right, but ordinarily, when you've got a Fifth Amendment assertion in a civil case like this, the practice is to put the witness on the stand and make him take the Fifth in front of the jury in response to each individual question for the profound effect that tends to have on the mind of jurors.
Right, and also then the ability to ask the follow-up questions and to fill out all those details, whereas instead what we had was sort of them taking the Fifth on generalities, and I'm not sure that the full meaning of that came across.
So you did ask to do that.
Yes, we did. But then again, once again, even without that evidence, the witness testimony against Brzezinski and McDermott, it wouldn't have mattered if we could have put Brzezinski and McDermott on the stand to take the Fifth, because we needed some kind of substantive evidence to back that up, to parallel it, and that's what the evidence that was excluded would have done.
The jury got the standard instruction on the Fifth Amendment inference?
Correct.
And it was or was not told that it needed, in addition, some affirmative evidence to prove the case?
It didn't
I know
say,
that's the law, but I don't know whether...
It didn't say either way. What it said was you may infer...
Right.
Defense counsel said it's not even evidence.
It's not even evidence, right. It's not even evidence, and raised this implication or the perception that they weren't taking the Fifth because of anything to do with what we were talking about in this case.
Well, it was very unfortunate, if I recall the term, at the beginning of the closing. It's unfortunate that their testimony was not available.
That was
what defense counsel said.
That they had wanted to testify. She gave the jury the perception that the officers actually wanted to testify about this incident and describe and tell their side of the story, which wasn't quite the case. So I say
the jury would have been able to make its own judgment about that if they had laid eyes on the witnesses.
Absolutely. And that whole argument would have lost all of its effectiveness. To say they're taking the Fifth because of something else that it has nothing to do with this pattern of misconduct, and just like they didn't buy it with Souchocki, they couldn't have bought it with McDermott. And
Ms. Anthold, could I ask you about a couple of other matters quickly? You all asked that if, in the event that we grant a new trial, it go back to the same judge as distinct from the usual practice under Circuit Rule 36.
I think we didn't. I don't think we specified. I could be wrong.
Don't think you what?
I'm not sure that we specified.
Appellants request further that pursuant to Circuit Rule 36, the case be remanded to the same district judge for trial.
Then we did.
Okay.
And that's fine. Yes.
Okay. Then
I
you want to explain that? Or?
It was clear, and I'm sure you saw from the record, that the judge was trying, especially with these 403 analysis, he was trying to do the analysis.
Okay.
But he was mistaken about some things, and we're sure he can correct those.
Mistaken about the aliases?
Not so much about the aliases. Allowing, obviously, to us that was incredibly significant, to allow the defendants to parade 18 arrests before the jury. Take a plaintiff who's already an underdog and just pile it on to make sure that nobody really cares about
him. He did have credibility problems. Let me ask, there was all this back and forth about whether Officer Souchocki's indictment was going to be mentioned. And I frankly am not sure I fully understand all of the ebbs and flows of that. But in the end, as I understand it, it was mentioned. The dismissal of it was not, which was what the defense wanted to get in. Were you prejudiced in any way by that?
We were prejudiced to the extent it didn't play out the way we had an anticipated in the pretrial hearings, obviously. But we were prejudiced in that the unexplained indictment kind of played into that whole theory that we were talking about before, about, oh, there's some trouble that has nothing to do with this, and it's unrelated. Because we weren't able to do the second part of what we wanted to do, which was talk about the scope of those indictments, that it wasn't, he wasn't indicted over a car accident or something unrelated. This was the pattern of SOS misconduct.
The Thompson incident wasn't part of the indictment, but other similar incidents were.
Right.
And this came in through the testimony of the chief of the state's attorney's office?
Right. We had testimony from the state's attorney who appeared in court and the chief of the felony prosecutions unit.
I'll give you a little time.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Luz?
Good morning. May it please the court. At the outset, I wanted to clarify, because I think it's important, what the nature of the conspiracy claim that went to the jury was. It was not about the false arrest and the gun planting. The false arrest claim had been dismissed at summary judgment because it was time barred. The conspiracy claim that went to the jury was a conspiracy to deprive Mr. Thompson of his due process rights based on the alleged Brady violation, the failure to turn over impeachment evidence. In fact, for that reason, the district court gave a jury instruction that the jury was not to consider evidence about the gun for purposes of the due process violation that was being tried in this case. So
I'm not tracking. Why was the evidence about the gun planting not relevant to the Brady claim?
It was relevant. The Brady claim is based on a failure to turn over material impeachment evidence.
Right, which such as I planted a gun.
That would be the exculpatory evidence that the district court said that's not what is at issue here.
Why is that not at issue? That's the heart of the case.
The heart of the case is whether or not the officers turned over material impeachment evidence. A Brady claim wouldn't be based on...
Which is to say they used a throwaway gun.
If Thompson wanted to bring a Brady claim based on that, he couldn't, because he knew that at the time that he was arrested that those were false.
Well, he couldn't bring that, though, until his conviction was set aside. Heck would have prohibited that, right?
Right.
So the claim was late?
This claim, the Brady claim is not based on the failure to tell Thompson that the officers falsified evidence against him in the form of the planted gun, because Mr. Thompson knew about the planted gun. That wasn't exculpatory evidence that he didn't have when he went to trial. What this claim was based on was a failure to turn over material impeachment evidence that he could have used at his trial. That's the way this case was tried.
And that evidence was what? The evidence of the conspiracy and misconduct in the SOS unit?
The defendant's involvement in the broader allegations of misconduct that could have been used to impeach Officer Souchacki and Officer McDermott at his criminal trial. That is the nature of the claim.
We're pretty far beyond allegations with respect to that SOS unit, right?
There was some evidence.
A number of them have gone to prison.
Not these defendants.
Not these defendants, but others have.
Correct. Okay, but of course here, the central focus is what material impeachment evidence was withheld that could have been used at Thompson's trial.
Right, but it's all bound up with the claim that a gun was planted on this plaintiff. I mean, that's his underlying claim.
That is true.
That he was not guilty of this weapons offense because Officer Souchacki went in the alley and came back with a gun. And the two officers testified against him that he possessed it, and that was false, and that there was a lot of impeachment evidence out there that would have disclosed these officers' culpability in a widespread conspiracy on the part of the SOS unit to falsely accuse defendants.
And it is in that light that the district court made the evidentiary rulings that it did.
Right. It seems to me that viewed in that light, all of this evidence should have come in. And that the similarity issue of requiring the evidence to be quite similar to the gun planting charge in this case is the wrong lens through which to look at this case.
Well, there were several different reasons given for each of the witnesses who were excluded. One of three reasons was given for each. Either the incident did not involve any of the defendants, the incidents were too dissimilar, as you just mentioned, and that was for two of the witnesses, or that they were too remote in time.
Yeah, the second two of those reasons are completely off base when this claim is properly understood. You don't need to have a high degree of similarity in a conspiracy claim like this, and the temporal limitation just isn't there. This conspiracy extended for a significant period of years, and the 18-month or 2-year difference between some of these incidents is irrelevant.
I believe a high degree of similarity is necessary, because if you were bringing in this evidence in Mr. Thompson's criminal trial, unless there were a degree of similarity, that kind of evidence would not be used to impeach Officer
Chichok. Oh, sure it would. You better believe it would.
Well,
it doesn't matter exactly how he framed other defendants. It's the fact that he does it at all.
It needs to be relevant. It needs to bear on whether it needs to come in under a 404B type analysis.
Right.
It would need
highly probative impeachment evidence that would come in any criminal trial.
This isn't 404B in the first place.
The reasons the officers might have to engage, or the conduct involved in an illegal search and a seizure and excessive force, do not bear on what the motive might be to fabricate evidence. That an officer might do that in one situation doesn't necessarily mean it would have the same motive or intent to plant evidence on someone else in another situation.
You're parsing it a little too finely, I think.
That's exactly the kind of inquiry the criminal court would have to undertake. And it's extremely prejudicial otherwise to suggest that one kind of misconduct would involve falsification, that a witness would also come into court and testify falsely under oath because they conducted a search or seizure without probable cause.
How about the fact that somebody sometimes gave false names and birth dates on some occasions? That's pretty relevant to credibility, right?
That is very relevant to credibility.
So the defendant's credibility wouldn't be affected by a willingness to falsify grounds for other criminal charges and searches?
Well, this kind of evidence wouldn't come in state criminal court under 608B as was allowed in this civil lawsuit here in federal court. Now, if you want in Illinois state criminal court, if you want to offer other acts of misconduct to impeach, you have to do it for some purpose, some 404B type purpose, not simply to impeach the credibility of the witness, to show their character for truthfulness or untruthfulness. Now, and so those are the reasons given for two of the witnesses who were excluded. And again, Mr. Wisniewski was actually not excluded, but Mr. Thompson withdrew his challenge to that witness without making a case for the similarity after the judge had withheld ruling. Now, as for the other witnesses, of course, the other SOS officers who would have come in to testify, putting Ms. Officer Villarreal to the side for a moment, those incidents did not involve any of the defendants. And clearly it was no abuse of discretion for the district court to disallow testimony about incidents that did not involve any of the defendants. And it was no abuse of discretion to exclude Officer Villarreal on the ground that the incident was too remote in time. These incidents happened in May of 2005, and they had little probative value about what evidence Officers Brzezinski or McDermott, none about Officer McDermott, because he was not there at all, that Officer Brzezinski would have had about a pattern of misconduct that could have been disclosed a year and a half earlier during Thompson's criminal trial.
Why would that be?
It happened a year and a half earlier. It's hard to see how this indicated that this kind of conduct was occurring a year
and
a half.
The SOS misconduct was occurring over the course of many years. This is not that long afterwards.
The SOS conduct.
And it's while his appeal is still, Thompson's appeal is still pending.
Even if SOS conduct as a general matter occurred over many years.
Involving one of the defendant officers in this case.
Involving
a planted gun.
To hold Officer Brzezinski liable, Mr. Thompson would have to show that Brzezinski knew about this pattern and practice of misconduct.
Well, he was one of the officers involved in the Villarreal incident, right?
Yes, in 2005. There's no basis to suggest that he knew about any kind of this kind of misconduct that should have been disclosed to impeach witnesses at Mr. Thompson's trial in 2003.
Well, how do you prove a conspiracy otherwise, other than by a pattern of conduct from which the jury can draw inferences about an agreement?
You can prove a pattern of conduct if you have evidence that is, you know, you would consider all the normal factors you would in deciding whether it's admissible, whether it's close in time. You need evidence to show that
this
it's probative.
This is highly probative evidence. The reasons for excluding it had to do with the time frame, which seems to me is a non-issue here because this is an ongoing conspiracy.
It's an ongoing conspiracy that goes on after Mr. Thompson's trial. What happens after that point just does not reveal, unless it's really close in time to the trial, that Officer Pinsky knew anything.
Why? You keep asserting that without saying why.
A Brady claim is about the prosecution's prosecutorial conduct that deprives a defendant of a fair trial. So Mr. Thompson has to show that
officers were complicit in a pattern of police misconduct that included fabricating evidence, fabricating charges, fabricating searches, and it all occurred over the course of a several-year period before and after his trial and while his appeal was still pending. Why is that
it doesn't matter
not
if it
relevant?
It's not relevant because what happened after his trial could not have been admitted into his criminal trial to impeach Officer Suchocki or
But to prove Hunter. The conspiracy, you can prove events afterwards. We do that all. We let that happen all the time in criminal cases.
Nevertheless, to be sure, some evidence did come in. There was a 2004 incident that came in. But the further out you get in time, the less probative value it has here. The district court did not abuse its discretion considering how far out this incident was. It's one of the usual criteria for assessing
whether... Let me get at this a different way. The events after Mr. Thompson's trial had to factor into the state's attorney's decision to dismiss the case.
The events that happened
there's
after
no conceivable way that those events did not factor into that decision.
It does. But when we're talking about a Brady violation, we're talking about the denial of a trial right. So what happened afterwards does not show that these defendants violated Mr. Thompson's right to a fair trial by withholding evidence that could have been used to impeach witnesses at his trial. It just didn't exist yet. I understand that there was an appeal and that and then a reversal and that there may have been another trial, but of course that trial hadn't occurred yet, so there was no Brady violation and failure to disclose for the retrial either.
I thought you told us earlier, the failure to disclose the conspiracy. So they had to prove the existence of the conspiracy.
No, yep. The conspiracy alleged is amongst the defendants to deprive Mr. Thompson of his of material impeachment evidence.
Which was the evidence of the conspiracy itself, right?
The SOS misconduct.
Of the pattern of misconduct, as Mr. Thompson.
Right. How many officers were in this SOS unit?
That's not a matter of record, there's certainly nothing to indicate that it was such a small unit that everybody knew everything that was going on.
That's why I asked the question.
Mr. Thompson did not put on evidence about the size of the unit, and it's not in this record, but there's no basis in this record to assume that it's so small that everyone knew everything that was going on when they weren't even present, you know, at that particular incident. And another reason why Officer Villarreal, Mr. Temple's testimony was properly excluded is that neither of those incidents revealed that evidence could have been used to impeach officers who testified at Thompson's trial because only Officer Brzezinski was present, and he did not testify at Thompson's trial. Officer Suchocki and Officer McDermott did. And there's nothing about what Officer Brzezinski saw or did on those occasions that could have been used to impeach Officer Suchocki or McDermott at Thompson's criminal trial. The failure to disclose evidence that would impeach only a witness that is not called by the prosecution is not a Brady violation. We cite this court's decision in Mosin on that, and Mr. Thompson has not responded to that.
Well, the prosecution had a duty to disclose it nonetheless.
The prosecution only has a duty to disclose material impeachment evidence.
Right, and before trial, it was plausible that Brzezinski was going to be a witness as well as McDermott and Suchocki.
But since Officer Brzezinski was not a witness, that did not, the failure to disclose
information. The claim against Brzezinski, though, is he's just part of the conspiracy, right?
To the extent he's just part of the conspiracy.
Failure to intervene, part of the conspiracy.
Right, but if he does not, in his role, whatever participation he may have had in the conspiracy, if he did not have evidence that could have been used to impeach Officer McDermott or Suchocki, who were the witnesses at Thompson's trial, that would not be material impeachment evidence under this court's holding in Mosley.
No, but if he's part of the conspiracy to engage in this pattern of conduct and conceal it, the plaintiffs still have a claim against him, right?
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, if he is part of the pattern and he conceals it, I don't really see how that fits into either the conspiracy that is based on the Brady due process.
Failure to disclose information that could be used to impeach McDermott and Suchocki, namely the pattern of police misconduct and concealment.
Only to the extent that he had information that Officer McDermott or Suchocki were involved in the pattern of police misconduct, and these incidents don't show that. I see my time is up. We do ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Anna, I'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you. Your Honors, just to quickly address a couple of those issues, the SOS unit is quite large, but this was about specific teams within the SOS unit, which were quite small officers who worked together day in and day out.
What do you mean by quite small?
I don't have the exact number, but under 50, we're talking about teams. I think there's about 10 officers on a team, and this is two or three teams who work quite closely together. On the issue, if I could, Your Honors, please address the issue of the fees, which hasn't yet been raised, but is the second half of the appeal. Just real quickly, the issue here is that the district court, it reduced the fees based on the Hensley factor of lack of success and the settlement, but it didn't apply the analysis that's required by this court's case law. And while fees can be reduced for lack of success, they should not be the analysis that has to accompany that has to consider several things, and those things are not a strict numbers comparison. This court has expressly rejected that a couple times, and that's exactly what happened here when you look at the district court's opinion. It cites the case law, but it doesn't apply this court's case law. Instead, it just switches to a strict comparison of numbers or how many claims were there at the beginning and how many claims were at the end without looking at the complexity of the case, the difficulty of the case, and the success that was achieved. And while it wasn't the full success that we had hoped, it was a significant success, and it was the core of Mr. Thompson's claims. And this court has held when you're looking at fees in these circumstances where it is a mixed verdict on interrelated claims, that what you're looking at is were the hours a reasonable means to that necessary end. And to conduct that analysis, you have to look at the complexity of the case. You have to look at more than the bare numbers.
Would you agree with me, Ms. Anholt, that there can be a real dilemma for counsel when they are trying to decide whether to accept a settlement proposal that has the endorsement of the district judge, when that district judge will also be deciding the ultimate amount of any fee if this case does not settle?
Certainly, that can be a difficult situation.
Mm-hmm.
And the court's recommendations are therefore fairly meaningful to get a sense of the assessment of the case. And here, plaintiff was willing to accept the court's recommendations at every step of the way. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.